Are you excited to hear about Africa? Yeah. Well, we're excited to talk about it. I was kind of just going on fumes last Sunday. I don't know about Spencer, but I can speak for myself. Grab that other chair over there, Spencer. Man, I was jet lagged. I was out of it, and it took me the better part of this week to kind of get back to normal chemically and everything from just being gone and spending 20 hours on a plane and three planes, actually, between Africa, Paris to New York, New York to Cleveland, three legs of a very long journey. And so it's good to be back. And we're going to talk a little bit this morning about our time in Africa. Yeah, as the kiddos come in, Deborah wanted to bring the youngsters in to hear about this too. I think you guys are going to like some of the stuff you see. And we're excited to share it with you. Let me move these out of the way so you can all see Spencer in his Africa Jam Jams. That's what I call them. And stand up, Carlos. You can see Carlos got some. Katie got a dress. None of my family or myself got African clothing. We got some other souvenirs, but we're going to just start today telling you a little bit about our trip. I'm not sure how this little stand works here. Maybe like that. And so we just kind of wanted to talk about some of the things we saw, some of the things we did, and some of the things we learned. Thank you, Lauren. I'm not tablet savvy. It's okay if it lays flat. I can still see it. So we started out on Wednesday evening here in Cleveland. We left Cleveland at 5 p.m. and the journey took us. Well, there should be a couple of little arrows there to Paris, to New York first, then to Paris, and then to Cote d'Ivoire, Benin. Cote d'Ivoire is the largest city in Benin, although it's not the capital city. We went through Porto-Novo, which is the capital of Benin, on our journey northward to Basila, which is where we was kind of our base of operations during our time there. But Cote d'Ivoire is the largest city. That's where the president of the country lives. We flew, of course, into the Cote d'Ivoire airport at night. That was Thursday night by the time we arrived in country. And so we then got to go to our Cote d'Ivoire guest house, and for some reason it was called the German guest house. Cassie, I don't know what the connection was there, but it was a nice, comfortable place, kind of like a hostel. And those are not princess beds, okay, for Spencer and I. Those are mosquito nets. And although we had the nets and everything, we took plenty of bug spray and bug wipes, I don't remember ever getting any mosquito bites, but it was nice to know they were there. Matter of fact, Spencer, give me a swig of your water there. I'll drink out of this side. I'm not sick, but I wanted to just share this one last little bit of the trip with you. This is my last malaria pill, and so they recommend you take them for a week after you get back. So this morning, you're part of the Africa trip, the Africa experience. Okay, Africa, until next time. Our accommodations were really nice. You know, I don't know what you all were thinking. I know kind of what I was thinking when we first talked about going to Africa. All right, I better take a sleeping bag and a bedroll because I'm going to be on the ground. But nope, they have beds. They have buildings with walls and roofs and all kinds of things. What were you expecting? And they had AC. Yeah, you want to get a microphone, you can. You can share whatever you feel led to share here. So that was Wednesday and Thursday getting there. Thursday night we stayed in Cote d'Ivoire, and then Friday was road trip day, and we drove from Cote d'Ivoire northward about halfway up the country to Basila. Basila is a city much smaller than Cote d'Ivoire, of about 10,000 to 20,000 people, and that is where we stayed during our time there. And some of the things we saw, some of the just big general observations that I saw, I kind of expected the developing world, Africa, to be a little more, you know, slower pace, you know, a little slower moving. No, everybody in Benin is on the go. Everybody's going somewhere all the time. All night long, in our guest house in Cotonou, we heard little beep, beep. Everybody has a motorcycle or a moped, these little tiny motorcycles, and they all have little beep, beep horns on them. And the horn in Africa, this is something I noticed. If an African person were to come to the States and use their horn like they do over there, they would die. They'd get shot pretty quickly after they arrived here. And I told that to Mark, our guide, because he just constantly is using the horn. But they use the horn as a courtesy. It's to let people know, hey, I'm coming. I'm about to pass you. I'm coming around you. I'm here. Just communicating. So everybody's on the go, and I mean everybody. Daddy's on the go. Mom is on the go. I don't know if you can see, but that is a child on her back right there, along with the groceries on her head. Everybody's going somewhere. That is a three-wheeled moto truck with a big load of bottled water, because you just don't drink the water over there. You have to drink bottled water if you want to stay healthy. Everybody's taking everything they own everywhere all the time. It's just a culture on the go. This was on our way back to Cotonou from Basila, but I thought I'd put it in here just to give you a sense of how many people they can fit into a vehicle. Blows my mind. I don't know if you can see, but inside the truck, and not just the three dudes on the back and the four people in the cab, but there's probably six or seven people in the back of that truck. And I swear, it just about turned over more than once with the load there. Cattle are on the go. This was just coming outside of Cotonou. They have feedlots and livestock markets where the cattle come. And so this is one of the videos. Nate, if you just click on that, get our first little video here.
Do you need a weasel?
No.
I'm going to drop you.
There's a goat. Got the black goat there.
Now, are they herding them?
Ready?
Are they herding?
The cow?
Yeah.
They're moving them.
They're not hurting them. They're herding them. And that, again, that's in town. Okay? So you just never know what you're going to see. And there's all the motorcycles. You see that? The motorcycle brigade. Even the termites are on the go. First time I saw one of these, I thought, okay, there's a giant ant hill. I want to stay away from that. It's termites, not ants. And they're everywhere, and that's a really small one. We saw some 12, 15 feet high. Just giant, ornate termite houses. And everybody's selling stuff there. Everybody's a salesman, it seems like. Everybody's got something to sell or trade, and there are people on every street corner with things. Fruits and veggies were a big one. This is a tropical country, so the growing conditions are superb there for all kinds of fruits and veggies. This was just outside of the German guest house as we left Cotonou that morning. Oranges, carrots, you name it, it's there. And how does all this fresh fruit get to the city, you ask? Well, it gets there like this. Go ahead, Nate, and play this one. Whoops, back up one. All right.
Right there.
Gets there like that.
Yeah.
Those are oranges, okay? They pick them while they're still green, and they load them in the Subaru station wagon to the top and take them into town. So the roads, this is probably the equivalent of our Route 84, two-lane. But, you know, if you kind of grade the American roadways and the Africans on a comparative, this would probably be about a two-lane Route 84. Very rough, unpaved, unimproved. This is a major river that we're crossing, and it's a one-lane bridge. And so it was a little painful being in the back of a three-row seat SUV for 10 hours. Estimated from our guide, Mark, who you're going to meet in just a minute, he said, it'll take about 6 hours, 10 hours in the back seat with Spencer. So we bonded.
It was like a deep squat the whole time.
Yes, the seat, very, very close, no foot room. I was doing this for 10 hours just to have room. This is Mark. Mark is a Beninese man. He's our guide. He speaks French and English. He works with an organization called Reach the Rest, which is an organization endorsed by the Southern Baptist International Mission Board, but it's not directly supported by Southern Baptists. And what Reach the Rest do is they identify people who are citizens of countries where there is a low or no International Mission Board presence. And Benin no longer has International Mission Board missionaries there, but they discipled Mark, and he is very close to the Singerman family, who I've mentioned a couple times. He grew up around them and discipled him, and now he coordinates mission teams who come to Benin from the States, like our church and several other churches around the country. So he'll be coming next spring and summer as well for a couple of months to visit partner churches here. But he was with us the whole time in Africa, a very, very intelligent young man and good with logistics and all that. So we stopped along the way a few times from Cotonou to Basila. They have roadside cafes. I can't even remember. It was rice and maybe fried cheese or something that we ate at this restaurant. You see the ever-present bottles of water. And this was our little cafe, and just very warm people everywhere you go, very friendly, very interested in Americans and why we would be in their country, and in a good way. So this was a lady and her family that we got to see along the way. We also encountered black market gasoline. That's not sweet tea. That's not sun tea in that glass jar. That's a 20-liter glass jar that's originally made for wine, but is turned into a container for gasoline. And you'll see these stands all along the way. He was really not mean, although he looks mean. But we would, you know, a lot of times if there is some kind of issue at the port and fuel is not able to get by truck northward to the gas stations, people will, in their cars, bring jars of gas from neighboring Nigeria to the east, which is a huge exporter of petroleum products. They'll bring them across and they'll sell them at the roadside in little stands like this. And so the gas stations were out of gas, so we had to buy contraband black market gasoline. And everybody does it, and they really can't police it. And you'll notice he put a rag over the funnel as he poured it in there. It's because this gasoline is very unrefined. It's got a lot of impurities and dirty stuff in it, so to try and protect the vehicle, you have to change your fuel filter about every 3 months over there, Tom. Just so you get pretty good at changing fuel filters, I guess. So we finally make it to Basila and to a nice dinner and to the Hotel Romance. And so I'm pretty sure, Nate, if you want to give everybody, Spencer gives you a great tour of the Hotel Romance in Basila. Turn up the volume. That's right. Spencer and I shared a room.
This is John talking to Mark about expenses. It's his wife, Sue. This is the gate we walk through to get to our hotel. Here's the restaurant we eat at. There's a little sitting area we have at the hotel. This is like the courtyard, I guess. It's a residence area. I think the people that work here live there. Air over there. You can hang your clothes up if you get done washing them. Those are like showers.
Not our showers, though. Just outdoor showers.
It's like a service room. It's the water resonator thing. We get our water from, we think it's gravity fed to running water. More sitting area. It's John and Sue's room. This is the room Darren and I are staying. Yeah. You dressed?
Yeah.
This is our room. Darren sleeping, and we have hearts on the walls, because this is Hotel Romance.
Hotel, welcome to the hotel, Hotel Romance.
Little TV.
Such a lovely place.
We have air conditioning.
Such a lovely place. We're living it up at the hotel, Hotel Romance.
This is like a changing area. They have a hanger thing here.
Hope you like it here.
And here's the bathroom. You have running water.
Right down
and toilet flushes. That's our shower. And there's a bucket here in case we run out of water.
So in case you were thinking, all right, Darren and Spencer are going to go to the bush and live in the wilderness for 10 days. No, we had pretty nice. I mean, it might rate a half star to one star on hotels.com or something like that, but it was very comfortable for us. It got very cold at night and with the air conditioner on, and Spencer and I had to snuggle a little bit to keep warm, but it was good. So that's some of what we saw, and some of the things that we would see daily, our accommodations. I want to talk a little bit about what we did now, which is the whole purpose of the trip. It wasn't just a sightseeing trip. It was a ministry trip. And what we did during the day was in the mornings we would train local pastors or local church leaders to use Bible stories as a witnessing tool. Just to open up, not even open the Bible, but just the stories that they know. And many of them know a good number of the stories in the Bible, and we were able to share a few with them, and just a way of engaging people with Bible stories as a way of telling them about Jesus and as a way of encouraging other Christians with any number of difficult circumstances they might be facing. And so and then in the afternoons, we would go to different villages to encourage churches and leaders in those places. And so where we did our storying training was at the Basilla Baptist Church. There it is. A stick wood structure with a concrete poured floor. And you see next door to the left there behind me is the unfinished future Basilla Baptist Church. And that's how it goes with construction over there. You build till you run out of money. And then when you get more money, you build another layer of cinder blocks, and eventually you have a finished structure. And everywhere we would go, we would see buildings like this. They look abandoned, but they're not. They're just on hold. And so that's the case also with Basilla Baptist. And Mustafa is a really, really cool individual that we got to meet. Would you like to tell him a little bit about Mustafa?
Mustafa is the leader of the Basilla Church. He's really cool because he's like I told Darren, he's like Paul to the guys. He's got about seven main guys that he leads, and then there's like another seven of them that are kind of falling in to see if they can, you know, get leadership. So at one point on Saturday, I think it was Saturday, we had like 14 guys there and a few females, a few wives. And it's just cool because he's kind of like the catalyst. He's the one that goes out. He's a true evangelist. You know, he doesn't, that's what he does all the time.
So. Almost all the village visits that we made, Mustafa guided us there and knew people there and introduced us to people in those villages. He's a real networker. He is definitely an E on the INTP, the Myers-Briggs. He's an extrovert, okay? Evangelistic, very cool guy. And I'm glad we got to meet him. He's a radio host. He hosts a half-hour Bible broadcast twice a week. And this was Sunday night for one of those. We got to go to the station there just outside Basilla and get a tour there. And shortly after that, he began his Sunday night broadcast. And this was back at our storing time. I think this was the first day. And we all introduced ourselves, the Americans there, through our translators, Mark, who you can see there, and also this lady in the yellow. Her name is Yolanda. And we got to meet a good number of these local church leaders and some of their wives, as Spencer said, and some of their children as well came. We got to talk to them about where we were from. I taught those three little kids to say, "Go Buckeyes." And they had no idea what they were saying, but they said it with enthusiasm, which was encouraging. And so we began to do some storytelling and story training, and I think it was very well received. The men, as you can see, that's only about half of the guys who are in the room. The other side of the wall has got people there, and so we just kind of took turns sharing stories, and then we would ask them to share a story with us. And one of the things we learned from Mark on the drive up from Cotonou was that the African cultures, particularly in West Africa, people learn two main skills. And he compared it to where in the United States, where we learn text and words on a page or words on a screen, that's very much a big part of our communication with one another. In their culture, it is speaking and listening. Those are their primary skills. They have Bibles, and most of these guys can read their Bibles, and most of them can write, but their main communicative skills are just talking and listening to people. So the storying was actually a really good technique for them because we'd tell a story, and they could recall it for us almost word for word just because they grab it. Their minds are very quick in that way. So I think there were about nine guys, nine or ten. These are some of the faces that we saw every day. These men are just full of the Holy Spirit. You'll see here in a moment, we got to spend some time worshiping with them and being encouraged by them. Jimon, man, he's got some style. I don't think I could pull off the pink pants, but he pulled it off. Some of these guys are young. Some of them are in their early 40s. And by the way, the average male life expectancy, about 52. And for a female, about 60, a little bit over 60. So they don't live super long over there. And so the earlier we can get these guys won to Christ and trained to lead churches, the better. And West Africa, if you look at population maps of the world and where the human population is ballooning, West Africa is like the epicenter. I think it's well over half of the population is under 15. Everywhere we went, children, everywhere. And that's why driving north from Cotonou to Basilla was so nerve-wracking. I mean, we were just exhausted physically, emotionally. We were nervous wrecks by the time we got there because they don't have overpasses where kids can walk. Kids just walk across roads, and they don't have, like, school zones. It's go as fast as you can. What they do have are speed bumps, and so they're actually pretty effective at getting people to slow down because it could be somebody's whole herd of goats that jumps out across the road in front of you or two or three kids. And we had some kind of close calls over there.
I just wanted to say something about the guys. Yeah, the guys, it was really encouraging for us because John went with the other team 2 years ago, and they didn't really know where the guys were spiritually. And I think this trip was really effective because and the fact that we knew what the guys, where they were. And a lot of these guys, they gave up their families. They disowned by their families because they decided not to do voodoo, or they decided to, follow Jesus. And they made the decision, and they were disowned by their families. So I think, like, probably about three or four of them, at least, I can remember, that we heard their testimonies. They were disowned. And so it was really encouraging for us because they were, you know, they wanted to, you know, live for Jesus. They gave everything up for him.
Yeah. It was a really, really good back and forth. We had a lot of good dialogue with these guys and learning, like Spencer said, about what they had to give up. You know, when you think about it, honestly, I've not had to give up much to follow Jesus. These guys have left families, been disowned, and it kind of gives you a new perspective on sacrificing for Jesus. It makes raising money, you know, and the few thousand dollars, you know, to go to a place like this not seem like such a big deal. I spliced together a couple of pictures here just to give you a little more sense of the space. And this is a time of worship where I was trying to keep time on a cowbell-like noisemaker up there. They got rhythm over there. They got soul, and they got everybody sings, and everybody sings loud. They don't have sound systems. I don't need them. It was very encouraging to worship with them, to share meals with them. We didn't get to talk a lot during mealtime just because that would take a translator, and translators have to eat too. But it was just nice to see them visiting and enjoying each other. And like Spencer said, these men and their families, they have become family because of the fact that they've had to leave, many of them, their biological families to follow Jesus. So here's kind of a group picture. This is our last day of storying. This was Tuesday. Jump in, Spencer, anytime you want to say something. And so, yeah. Yeah, questions. I'm sorry, I should have said that at the beginning. If you got questions as we go along, please ask them.
Why do they trust you? Because, I mean, from other experiences, usually you have to go through somebody. Is it because they trust Mark? Is it because they trust Mustafa?
Yeah, it's a chain of trust. Like you said, they trust Mustafa because he led most of these guys to Christ in the first place. And Mustafa trusts Mark. Mark is not in Basila on a regular basis. He lives in Kotno, so Mustafa trusts Mark. Mark brings the Americans over, and John, who has been there two other times before this trip. So most of these guys recognize him and remember him. And when a guy brings his wife, it says a lot to them about how important they are to you. And John brought his wife this time, and that meant a lot to them, that you would spend that money and take this time to come all the way here. It builds trust, you know. When you know that somebody's given up something to come a long way to see you, you want to make time for them. You want to believe what they say. But it is a chain of trust, like you.
And relationships for them are, like, extremely important.
Huge.
Mark had said that there were some churches that would come, and then they just stopped coming or whatever, and they just lost all kind of encouragement and kind of got them down. And that's why I think it's evident that John wanted to come back so many times, because, it's a part of relationship. Like, when we went, we were kind of crunch for time, I guess, between the training and seeing other churches, and John made it evident that he went back to see the people that he had talked to before that were further down the crazy road that, you know, we were off-roading. I think Darren's got a picture, basically off-roading, to see these guys, because it was that important that John went back and saw them again. Mm-hmm. Because it's really important. Relationships are extremely important to them.
So this was one of our afternoon visits. We visited a couple of small churches and a couple of the leaders. This is Jacques. He's one of the younger men. Not a great picture there with some backlighting. But anyway, we Mustafa is there to show us. And then we went to, this is in the next country over to the west, Togo, another small French-speaking West African country. We're right on the border, and so the Ani people group is spread across these two countries. And so we went just across the border to this village where we prayed, and I shared a story with the village king of Jesus welcoming the children. Again, there are children everywhere, and it just moved me to see all these children standing behind the king wanting to know why these white people were here. And so I just shared with the king the story of how Jesus did not refuse to spend time with children, but that he welcomed the children. And then we prayed for the king. And that's
Eve's home. It's one of the men that we saw before. That's his hut. That's his little house. And he was...
This is Eve and his wife and child here.
He was very excited to show us his house and his family.
And that's their church building behind them. And the church. And the kiddos. Who loved them some Spencer, let me tell you. And they love getting to see themselves on a smartphone screen. It wasn't discouraged.
A big thing is, I think Mark had mentioned a comment that if they didn't want it to happen, they wouldn't be sending their kids to church, because a lot of the times the adults are busy farming or whatever, because that's how they live. So they can only send the kids. So they send the kids, but if Mark had said if they had a problem with us or Christianity there, that they wouldn't be sending the kids to church. So a lot of the congregation is made up of women and kids.
This was a church right on the Togo border, and one of the leaders named Nikase, he was there and had several folks come out to greet us and meet us, and we prayed with them. And this was Sunday morning. We split up. Sue and I stayed in Basila, and I preached at the church in Basila, and Spencer and John went to a village called Kuruwari, where they shared some stories and had church with this small church there, also led by Nikase, who's sitting there in front of Spencer. That church is younger and not quite as far along. And the first village in Togo that we visited, where I told the story of Jesus and the kids to the king, we went back, and a few minutes later, when we were at Nikase's church there, this young man came bearing gifts from the king, and it was just one gift, the duck. This is a very nice gift, and he was very appreciative. And this king, by the way, he's a Muslim, but he was very thankful that we came to share the story about Jesus with them and just to pray with them. And so, yes, that became our dinner the next night, and it was really good. Mustafa's wife, Vivian, is her name. She fed us most of the meals we ate there. So then the next day we went in the afternoon to a town called Pira, which we passed through on the way up from Cotonou to Basila, a much larger church, much further along, and we got to work with some kids there, and Sue brought some drawings and coloring pages from Gateway West Church here in Cleveland and showed them to the children there, and so they were very glad to see us. And the little girl... I don't have my pointer. You can see Yolanda in the upper right here. That's our translator. This little girl right here, we prayed for her because just a few weeks before we came, some Christians in this church had laid hands on her and prayed for her, and God granted her to be released from sorcery, demon possession. She had come under demon possession from a family member, probably a relative who is involved in witchcraft and sorcery. They will pull children aside sometimes when they're very young, and they will put a curse on them. They'll have them, hey, eat these leaves or drink this potion or whatever that's been cursed, and they will be possessed by Satan. Witchcraft, voodoo, animism, it's very strong, very powerful in this part of the world. That's where it came from. And so this young girl actually had enough Christian family to recognize what was going on with her, and they prayed over her, and God released her. And so we just prayed to encourage her and her family as they continue to grow in Christ. But the younger they can be released from that, the better. The likelihood is that the further they grow, it's like stages. The deeper you get into sorcery, the less likely it is you're going to be brought out of it. So, yes, go ahead. Mark would be our contact for that. Anything that we would want to do, he would kind of coordinate with Mustafa, with the people in these different churches. But it's something that we could email and find out. You know, do you do Christmas Child or, you know, specific? Yeah, yeah. It is. Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't know about, I don't know the answer, honestly, but I would assume that there's something that could be done to bless these kids. So many kids. This is Job, one of the leaders with his wife and son. Again, this is one of the stronger churches. This is not an Ani church. This is a Nago people church. So we weren't just exclusively with the Ani. We went to, and this is a neighboring tribe, the Nago people, and Job is Nago. And so we translated. I spoke at this church as well on the 90 and 9, the lost sheep and the good shepherd that went to redeem the sheep. And it was translated from English to French, from French to Nago for the church. So pretty cool experience. Hallelujah and Jesus. That's all I know from this song. There's one more. The next one's a video as well. Nate. This is Mustafa leading worship with these kids. Wednesday was our last day in Basila in that region, and so we, John, as Spencer mentioned earlier, had built a relationship with a man named Allah's son, who, so he's a Muslim, and he is a chief in a village called Naborko. Huh? He is. He was. He was a Muslim, right. Yeah. We'll tell that story in a minute. So this was the longest day out to the bush. And there were some rough roads there. We had to do a little bit of off-roading with our trusty vehicle there. And Spencer got and I both got to ride on the motorcycle with Mustafa. That was a treat. I realized when I got back I probably shouldn't have shared that with Deborah, but we had a lot of fun. And we got to share the gospel. John, who's in the red shirt, got to share with Alasan, who's in the middle there right beside me. With the hat on. He is a Muslim, was a Muslim priest, And John shared the entire story called Creation to Christ, which we mentioned this morning, with him. It took him about 20 minutes to walk from creation all the way to the cross and Christ and why Jesus came to the earth. And he sat and listened. And when he was done, Alasan spoke and said, "I agree that Jesus is God's Son. And I agree that forgiveness is found in Him." And Mark made a comment that, you know, concerned me a little bit, but he said that, but Islam is still his everyday religion. So as a leader, as a Muslim leader in this community, it's going to take time for him to be baptized. That was my next question. I asked Mark that, well, does he want to be baptized? And Mark said Mustafa is working with him on bringing him to that, but there were other young men in the room. And so as a king, you kind of have to make those big decisions. You want to make those bigger decisions in private. And so, but we're just trusting that that God is at work in Alasan's life, that he is a believer now, but that now he needs to take those next steps and be baptized and set that example. And we could see this entire village come to Christ. When a leader gets, yeah, better, yeah. Islam has been in West Africa for almost 1,000 years. So it's going to take time, you know, and for a leader who's grown up knowing only Islam and voodoo, for him to convert to Christ, it's a big deal. You know, but the ramifications, the implications of that are, like I said, a whole village literally could come to Christ if a leader does. So we're praying for Alasan. You prayed for him. If you were using the prayer guide, you prayed for him before we left. And while we were there, you were praying for us and for him by name. And I hope you'll continue to do that as well. This was probably the most encouraging single visit that we made in a village. There is a church that's been planted there. The gentleman in the white, his name is Fulbert. That's right? Fulbert is how we would pronounce it, but it's Fulbert in French. And he is not a Baptist, but he's an evangelical, non-denominational church planter, and he has established a church there, and he knows Alasan, and so he and Mustafa are continuing to work with him, lead him to Christ. So it was a really great, encouraging visit. And these other young men who were there by Spencer, they were listening the whole time. They were in the room. We were in Alasan's house, and they were listening to the gospel the whole time. So we're just praying that that seed will grow. So meanwhile, back at the Hotel Romance, they leave the light on for you. We have a little downtime, maybe a late night snack. that is one large beetle. And no, I didn't actually eat it, but for drama's sake, yeah, we thought we'd throw a little bit of humor in there. So Thursday, we departed Basila and made our way back to Cotonou. This was a very arduous day of driving, very difficult. John, by the way, I didn't mention this. I'm really glad you guys were all praying, and I know that this helped us because John, before he left, had been told that he had a kidney stone. And so all the way north on the trip up to Basila, we had these bumpy, jarry roads with lots of swerving, missed potholes and things like that. By the time we got there that night, he was in a bad way, and he had a really rough night. But by midday the next day, he was feeling good. And God, I'm convinced, protected him and helped him over the course of our time there to have a good trip, good visit. But by the time we were leaving to go back to Cotonou, he started to feel bad because the roads, again, were awful on the way back. Even worse than when we came. We went a different way, and we spent about 2 hours on a dirt road. Again, they were fixing in the highway, but it hadn't been fixed yet, so we were, it was rough. And so we're very drained and tired by the time we got back. Just some scenes from along the way. Friday, we got a real treat. We got to go and out to the lake, which there's an inland lake. Cotonou is out on a peninsula, and so there's the Atlantic Ocean to the south, and to the north is a lake where you have a people group called the Ganvier people. And these people fled to the lake a few hundred years ago during the slave trade. One of the tribal leaders saw this lake, and he saw that there was an island out there, and to get away from the slave trade where you had intertribal warfare, and one tribe would conquer another tribe, and they would sell them to white slave traders, he took his tribe and moved out to the lake, and they built houses on the lake, and they fish, and that's where they've lived to this day, and their whole life is based on this lake and gaining their sustenance from that. So we have a video here of a fisherman. This is what I envision the disciples doing.
He got a prop. He got a prop, son.
Okay.
He didn't catch anything, so I imported. And this is the village, all on stilts. And this is just one of several hundred villages like this, all around this big lake. Thousands of people live in this village. And they are still mostly an unreached people group, although there are churches among them now. They start the children at 4 years old, learning how to operate a boat, paddle, engine, fish, you name it.
This is a hotel.
Yes. Yes, good question, Kathy. They do have a rainy season. They actually have two. They have two rainy and two dry seasons. So where we have four different seasons, they have two seasons, and they get them twice a year. And so this lake, for 4 months out of the year, is fresh water, and for 8 months out of the year, it's salt water. So during the rainy season, inland, when it rains, all that fresh water runs down, and the lake turns into fresh water. And then when the water rainy season stops, the water comes back in from the ocean and it turns into salt water. So what we learned, you've seen now what we saw and heard what we heard, and you saw what we did, working, encouraging, telling stories, sharing the word with leaders there. Some of the things that I learned, and I didn't put yours in here, Spencer, but you can share those, is that there were more Ani believers than we expected. The churches are very young, and the Ani people group is still classified as an unreached people group. They still need missionaries. They still need the gospel desperately. But there are more believers there, and it was very encouraging to get to go to these villages and see these children who know songs. You know, there's enough believers there for them to know songs about Jesus, to be able to sing those songs. So the work is underway. Much more than I had anticipated, but they still need help. Like in America, there are many false religions there. You have, of course, Islam. You have animism, which we would call voodoo, which basically is you worship anything you can't understand. So a tree. You know there's a tree there. You know that it's called a tree, but you don't understand where it came from or how it became a tree. So you You make a god out of that tree, and you make sacrifices to that tree. You dedicate your children to that tree, and they will slice their children's faces when they're newborns, and they'll make markings on them, and whatever the configuration is of those markings, it lets everybody know for their whole lives which deity, which god their parents believed in and worshipped. And so some of these Christians that we worked with had those markings on their faces, and they carry them all through their lives, and people will know, hey, your parents were, yeah, but they have a new god now. So they've been saved from that, but they carry those scars. And also there are some false quasi-Christian systems there, belief systems. One of them was called the Celestial Church. Now the Celestial Church kind of came about back in the 70s and 80s as an admixture of Christianity and voodoo. So basically what you have now is this really growing and thriving Christian group that offers people hope through Jesus and forgiveness of sin through Jesus, but does not require people to give up their animism, to give up their voodoo practices. And so it's really growing. And why wouldn't it? Oh, I can go to heaven and be with Jesus, but I can still keep my family and make sacrifices to my parents' gods. So American churches can still help. We can help in big ways by sending teams, small teams, short-term teams, and resources. But we need to avoid creating an unnecessary dependence on Western money, Western forms of church. They can do church how they feel led to do it as they read the Bible. And that's one of the things that the IMB and other missions agencies have discovered, is that we don't need to export American-style Christianity to the developing world. We need to export the gospel and let the Holy Spirit give shape and the Word of God give shape to how they do church. So, go ahead, Spencer. What did you pick up and learn?
I can't remember what I told you.
You sent me some, and I forgot to put them in the...
I don't remember. I think...
Something about family.
Oh, I just felt really at home with them. One of the things that really touched me was the ability to have a relationship with them, even though we didn't even speak the same language. Anything, you know, we really had minimal communication with them because, you know, there was an interpreter involved, and so I had to pull them aside to talk with them. But one of the guys, his name is Francis. He, because one of the cultures in Africa is, when you have anyone that's a close family friend or family member and they're older, the children are supposed to call them Papa, and the women they're supposed to call Mama, just as their parents. And one of the men, he had said this to me. He said, went to his little child, probably like not even a year old. He said, can you say bonjour, Papa, to me? And so that really affected me, because it's, I realized how they interpret, you know, between... with John coming and Mark and the relationship that we have, you know, they really appreciate us, and they really, you know, think that we're part of their family. And that's kind of what I wanted to say was, it was really touching to me, because though we're different skin and we have totally different languages, we still worship the same God. Like Darren, you know, both of us commented, they have a different style of worship. But it was cool to see that, you know, it was still the same. We just still worship God in a different way. But, you know, it was cool to see that they worship Him as well, and with the Holy Spirit moving and everything like that too, the same way. So,
yeah. So our question to you is, what will you see, and what will you do, and what will you learn when you go to West Africa or wherever the Lord may send you?